now on Bloomberg Radio.
I do feel like there's a lot of short-term trading going on right now because it's just so erratic.
The business aspect is something that's really universal, and it's a great thing for us to cover.
A new take on business, finance, and tech news.
People saying that maybe now is the time to buy Apple specifically.
I think that Amazon Prime is maybe the most important driver for Amazon itself.
Carol Masser, Corey Johnson.
More people listen to radio in America than watching TV.
Is that because you can kind of multitask?
I don't know. I mean, no one listens to radio with the sound off.
This is true.
This is the Bloomberg Advantage on Bloomberg Radio.
And you are listening to a special edition of the Bloomberg Advantage on Bloomberg Radio. Right now it is 5 o'clock right here on the East Coast. It means it's 2 o'clock on the West Coast. I did the math in my head, Carol, because there's engineers. We're in a room full of engineers. They're figuring all this stuff out themselves.
You continue to impress me, that's for sure. We are live at NJIT. It is one of the nation's leading public polytechnic universities. NJIT preparing students to be leaders in the technology-dependent economy of the 21st century. NJIT in University Heights district of downtown Newark, just 20 minutes from Manhattan by train. Got to tell you, my sister got her engineering degree here at NJIT, so it's fun to be here with all of you. Over the next 60 minutes, we're going to be talking with a bunch of individuals, some old tech, some new tech, some old tech reinventing themselves, and just how everybody's kind of trying to make their mark on the new world tech order, if you will. And they're also going to talk about how important science, technology, engineering, math, the STEM education is in order to achieve their goals at their specific institutions. So great panel up here, and so Corey and I want to kick it off. And we want to start with the gentleman next to me, who is Joe Taylor. He is the CEO of North America for Panasonic Corporation. And if I think about Panasonic, I think about in years past, this was a company that was known for a lot of consumer electronics, televisions. That was really yesterday, and you guys are reinventing yourself. Tell us about what you're focusing on now.
Yeah, I want to comment when you said old tech, new tech. Old tech is dead tech.
Old tech is dead tech.
So if you're still around, you're
so that Panasonic TNT tape deck, gone.
Gone. It's long gone. Okay. Yeah, so
you don't even know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
that's terrifying, I know.
They don't know phones without cords.
Unbelievable. Anyway, so talk about what you're doing.
So if I asked everybody in this audience what they thought of when they heard the word Panasonic, probably they say TVs or VCRs. That was a long time ago. In North America, our revenue is 90% B2B based. It's all tech based.
Business to business.
Business to business. Globally, less than 30% of our revenue comes from consumer products. And in Asia, we're still Asia's largest leader in appliances and consumer electronics. So the transition over the last 6 or 7 years has been profound, and most of that transition was led in North America, which is really the tech capital of the world.
So when you went through this sort of dramatic change, you guys were in some markets that were just evaporating. Margins were probably evaporating faster than those markets were evaporating. And you made this really big turn. You've already seen as a technology leader at that point, but I wonder how you look at all the things you could have done and selected the sort of individual things that you're on and that you guys are doing so well and profitable at now.
I'm going to write a book on this someday.
I think you ought to.
And make a lot of money. We made a lot of bad mistakes, and the reality is it was a burning platform. So we'll be 100 years old in 2 years, and there aren't many companies with our size and portfolio that make it to 100 years. But every company that comes close to 100 years struggles, every one you can think of. Some make it and some don't.
The mistakes are part of the process.
Huge mistakes are even bigger parts of the process. Yeah. And we had a true burning platform in 2010 and 11 and 12, we lost $25 billion. That's a huge amount of money because we didn't read the marketplace right, we didn't read the technology right, and we continued to invest in technology like plasma, for instance, that were disappearing in the rest of the world. And from those very difficult lessons and the survival of those lessons, we recognized that our portfolio was better suited to a B2B play, and not just in terms of the technology itself, but how you apply these technologies. Rather than hardware, could we provide a full solution? That is, mixing hardware and software and services along with it. And that was our savior.
It's interesting that you chose services. Right? You chose services means basically sending a bunch of people to help someone fix a problem, which means employing a bunch of people to do those kinds of things. And that can be a high-margin business, but something that a manufacturer rarely sees as one of their strengths.
You've just identified one of the key issues we had to face. Thanks. Where were you 5 years ago? Now he tells me what the problem was. I figured that problem out.
Forget the book now.
So we're I have more stories. So when we talk about
my ghostwriting gig, you can see it right now.
Yeah, we're not talking about consulting services. So we focused our technologies on our competencies. We didn't try to extend beyond that. And what we did is we tried to study our customers and their industries and know their problems before they did, and then say, do we have a technology that can help minimize or eliminate that problem? So it's a completely different view. If you're a manufacturing company, you just make stuff better than everybody else. And that worked for 85 years. But it doesn't work in this world anymore. Now you have to understand what your customers want, and then you have to make what they want.
How do you do that?
For Panasonic, we're still going through the process, but it's 180 degrees from an engineering, manufacturing, technology company to essentially a marketing consulting type company. It's a profound change for us. I think that's why it was easier for North America to lead that change, because North America is a little bit different culture.
But that's what I was thinking about. What do you do internally with your corporate culture, who's so used to the company and the identity being X, and now you're Y?
So you don't tell the board what you're doing till you already did it. and then if it works, the board says, good job. And if it doesn't work...
The board says that was my idea, right?
You're not far from the truth. But you know, I don't remember. I think it was Harry Truman. Somebody once said, anything's possible if you don't care who gets the credit. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of an important lesson in the corporate world. If somebody else wants to take the credit and they can help you achieve what you want, that's just fine. So our transition really is... Instead of focusing internally, it's a 100% external focus. Understand the markets and the customers. And it's much more difficult than it sounds.
All right, so let's talk about some of those markets. So one of the things you decided to focus on seems like a natural move from doing televisions and doing sound, which the Panasonic has had a long history of, were these giant screens. And with the Kentucky Derby coming up this weekend, it's a particular note because you guys have, I guess, the largest 4K screen anywhere at Churchill Downs.
So that's a great story. That's a good story over drinks. But so the Kentucky Derby is, I think,
I've got
about
water.
As far as you know, this
not
is
so
water.
Much, huh? Not
as
so
far
much.
As you know, this
not
is water.
So much. So the Kentucky Derby, I may be off by a year or two, but 2 years ago we installed the big digital sign. I think it was the 113th running of the Kentucky Derby. And if you've ever been there, they have a huge infield where they have 75,000 well-dressed drunk kids.
Yes.
And they've never seen more than maybe 10 nanoseconds of the race as it passes through the crowd. So this was the first time in history in 113 years that 75,000 drunks got to see the whole race. And I can't think of a better contribution to society than that.
Talk about contributions to society. You're working with Tesla.
We are.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So we provide all of the batteries for Tesla automobiles, 100%. We were the only...
Do you have a Tesla?
The company has a Tesla.
Okay.
I don't have a Tesla.
Does the company like the Tesla?
The company loves the Tesla. In fact, the company just got a brand new ex-Tesla, which is really a really fun car to drive. But the fun part of this story is not only could we create a battery that could meet the demands of Tesla and Elon Musk, because almost...
He is demanding, isn't he? I don't mean that as a negative. I think that's a good thing, having high standards.
I think it's remarkable. He can land a rocket ship on a barge in 5 years' worth of work, and NASA still...
I believe he calls it a drone ship, not a barge.
Don't get Corey going on Elon Musk. We'll be gone for hours.
So we partnered with them. We're providing all their batteries. We're building what's called the Gigafactory out in Reno, Nevada, which is not
huge.
Only the largest battery factory in the world, it'll be the largest footprint. It's 400 feet short of a mile, and it is this remarkable factory. We'll have... Between us and Tesla, we'll have about 6,500 employees when it's up and running full steam ahead. Slightly less than half of that will be our employees. And it's just a remarkable collaboration. If you think about the old and the new, this old conservative Panasonic company, and there's nobody more modern and more creative than Elon Musk, and how did we put these two things together? And I think that speaks really highly of the transformation that Panasonic is undergoing.
How important was it for you to have that relationship, to kind of show people this is... Okay, there's 100 years in the past of Panasonic, and here's maybe the 100 years going forward.
That's a really insightful question. I said to our marketing people, whether this project is successful or not, and it better be successful, this has done more to extend our brand and our image and the view from people that we're really a relevant company than any marketing campaign we could have considered.
So Carol and I both went to college in Manhattan. We both are city people. We both live in big cities. You chose to move your business from Secaucus to Newark. You're, I'm told that your numbers of employees commuting by using public transit went from something, 4% to 57%. It's a very urban story. Why would a company like Panasonic want to be in a city?
They have a crazy CEO.
What does a crazy CEO think that gives the company?
It depends on the time of year. So we were in Secaucus for 40 years, which is only 10 miles from here, and our lease was running up. And a couple of things we wanted to accomplish. Our goal was to be the number one green electronics company in the world by our 100th anniversary. So that was one factor. The other factor was our company has a belief that corporations have a responsibility to society. We have a responsibility to give something back to our communities. So when we first started looking, frankly, there were three choices, Atlanta, Chicago, or San Diego, because we already owned facilities there that we would just have to renovate. But the reality is we have 1,000 people in our headquarters building. A company's not going to move 1,000 employees anywhere. So then we would have had to say goodbye to a large number of people. Then what's the impact on those employees in the community? What's the impact on our shareholders? At the time, in addition to Dr. Bloom, who's very influential here, we had a mayor you might know who's now a state senator named Cory Booker. He's a very...
No relation to Cory Johnson.
You could be. You're both very charming.
Yes, yeah, so go on.
My brother did go to school with. We grew up in the same area.
Like
high school. Yeah. No, high school.
Oh, here, in New Jersey.
In New Jersey.
So Mayor Booker was very emphatic about his view for where the city could go. Our governor, Christie, was also emphatic. And over a period of time, frankly, the tipping point was not tax credits, which everybody says. And a lot of people don't understand what a tax credit is. When you get a tax credit, you don't get a check for anything. But anyhow, that's a different subject. The tipping point really was I thought that the city was ready, finally after 40 years of struggle, for a transformation. Mm. And I thought if a company like Panasonic made a commitment, which was a huge commitment, that maybe that would encourage other businesses and other people to move into a city. Because in the end, I believe, no matter what the government does, if you can't provide jobs, you can't change a city. And so the city needed jobs. And in the end, that was the final piece. That's why we moved. The other benefits were, we could get 60% of our employees to take mass transit. We could attract a younger generation of employees, frankly, because we were in an urban area. And I think it's only been not quite 3 years, but I'm thrilled with the move, and I'm thrilled with what I've seen over the last couple of years.
One last question. You recently held the Panasonic Creative Design Competition. What is that?
So Dr. Bloom and I put this together 25 years ago. It's funny how technology changes. 25 years ago, Panasonic was building lots of factories in North America, and I was really struggling finding industrial engineers and mechanical engineers. And by the time kids get to college, it's too late. How do you encourage younger kids to major in the sciences, and particularly engineering? So Dr. Bloom and I put together this concept with the university. Could we create this contest among high schools using robotics, create some real-life problem, and teach these kids how to solve them from an engineering perspective? That was 25 years ago. So we're not looking so much for industrial engineers anymore or even mechanical engineers. But the contest, just interesting enough, we just finished the 25th last week.
Right.
Now we're looking for software engineers and data analytics. And so even though the specific field of engineering has changed, the technology has become more and more important than we ever imagined. So we've had 25 years of great fun. I checked today, more than 4,000 high school students have gone through this program, and we've given out almost $1 million in scholarships over that time.
That's
so
fantastic.
We're really proud of that. Thank you, Dr. Bloom.
That's fantastic.
All right, well, let's move on. Thank you very much, Joe. Great stuff. We want to keep you up here. We might bring you in towards the end here. We can get everyone together. Joe Taylor from Panasonic. We're here for Joe, maybe? Live people in our own. David Rosenberg is with us. He's the co-founder and CEO of Aero Farms, which is a wonderfully insane idea. But it's about this notion of using technology to bring this farm-to-table movement to tables here by bringing the farm naturally to Newark. And places like it. David, talk to me about your business. And is that the problem you're trying to solve?
Yes, but we're trying to solve a few problems. One is when you look at the numbers, we have population growth, we have movement and urbanization. The world needs to produce approximately 50% more food by 2050. Meanwhile, on the other side, you have depletion of our arable land.
That's really soon.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when all these students will still be trying to buy some of that food and eat some of that food and feed their families.
There's a sense of urgency here.
Yeah.
So the world lost 30% of its land in the last 40 years. We have less of our good water that we have water contamination and water insecurity, so we're losing our good water. So here at Arrow Farms, we developed a way to take a seed, to grow that into a plant using 95% less water. Our productivity per square foot is about 88 times per square foot over a field farmer.
88 times.
We use 50% less fertilizers, zero pesticides, herbicides, fungicides. So we're about local food production at scale to feed mass populations. So here in Newark, we're building the world's largest vertical farm. We took an old, dilapidated steel factory, repurposing it to build this farm, hiring locally. So we're solving for a food desert, and we're bringing people in this highly perishable product where leafy green vegetables, spinach, kale, arugula, that's what we grow.
The stuff my daughter doesn't eat.
Sorry.
We're working on it.
Which is the most nutritionally dense food of all the food groups.
She shakes her head.
And there's wonderful opportunities because a lot of people, when you think organics, what people don't want is the chemicals on them. So when we say we found a way to grow without pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, that's a much healthier approach to food.
I was going to say, am I right in that you guys are slated to grow 2 million pounds of leafy greens a year, all without using a speck of dirt or a ray of sunlight? Is that it?
Correct. We grow without sun, without soil. So our growth media is actually recycled plastic, and it's 100% reusable. Plants don't need sun, they need spectrum. And we grow with LEDs. So in a 36-foot-high warehouse, we'll have 12 levels of growing, and that's moving to 14. We grow in these long tunnels where the plants, where our cloth, which is our dirt, if you will, gets seeded, and then on one side of the tunnel it grows, and on the other side it pops out 16 days later. So it's approximately 22 crop turns a year.
So that's fast. Even for leafy greens,
it's typically about 35 days.
Yeah, I was going to say 35 days,
cycle.
So yeah.
And because of seasonality, it's 3 crop turns a year, and we have 22. So by giving the same seed.
In California, that's one of the reasons California feeds most of the nation, because we don't have that issue. We can grow asparagus year-round, right?
Well, asparagus, but in leafy greens, it's very seasonal.
Right.
So even in Salinas, San Joaquin, you have 3 crop turns a year. Here, because it's fully controlled agriculture, we have 22.
But also shorter. Why is it shorter?
Why
is it half the time? It's not even shorter. It's half the time.
So we steal seconds, minutes, hours, days everywhere. So germination is typically an 8 to 10 day process. We could germinate, which is how you get a seed to open up, in literally 12 to 48 hours. By tricking a seed, it's time to grow. And then giving the plant what it wants, when it wants it,
how do you convince it it's time to grow?
I need to be somewhat opaque here, but you could trick it saying, all right, it's time to
wake
open up.
Wake up,
Is it Tinder for plants?
Right.
Grow, don't grow?
We find the connection points. And from a technology standpoint, we're here at NJIT. When Arrow Farms thinks about what we're good at, it is a combination of getting all the mechanical and electrical engineers, industrial engineers, process engineers, software engineers.
It takes a bunch of different people, right, to make it happen.
And then it's also coupling that with people that studied plant biology and horticulture, and it's the data analytics that pulls it together. So every seed to harvest, we're taking approximately 20,000 data points. So by the time our facility is growing, we're going to be gathering about 28 million data points a day. So our horticulture meetings look more like lectures and statistics, where we're trying to find the correlations of optimizing plant growth. And when we say optimizing, it's not just optimizing yield. It's optimizing for taste, for texture, as well as nutritional density. And understanding what are all, as human beings, if it's cold, we get goosebumps. If we get sunburned, we turn red, maybe.
So do you adjust the environment? If the temperature gets up a little bit warm, you just automatically adjust?
It's the environment, which is temperature, humidity, pH. It's also spectrum, so all the different spectrum under the sun. And it's not just what the plants want, but it's what they don't want. So we could remove the energy hogs of spectrum that aren't as efficient to plant growth. as well as its nutrients.
It's cool.
So on average, different varieties, we're putting in 18 different nutrients and micronutrients, and that mix may change depending on the variety.
So give me the products again. So you mentioned kale, you mentioned leafy lettuces, you didn't say which ones.
We've grown approximately 250 different types of varieties. So think short stem leafy greens. And the limitation of what we grow is not technology.
So it's more likely like economics. A butter lettuce than a romaine, for example, right?
We don't grow head lettuces. Okay. We grow more nutritionally dense lettuces of the baby leaves. So our top
arugula.
Customers like arugula. And here in arugula, we could accentuate the pepperiness of arugula. So you like arugula.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to is the flavor. Like what are you finding are the... Because, growing up in around agriculture, you think it's the soil that gives you the agriculture. My mother would boast about the black soil of Iowa that she grew up in, and that's what made the corn taste so good. You're not using soil.
Yeah, and this is, like, our head of operations, who's a PhD in molecular biology from Oxford, is from DuPont. So she headed up indoor growing at DuPont. She's from Iowa, and she was somewhat of a skeptic, and then she couldn't believe how we created a kale that was the best kale she ever had, an arugula, the best arugula, the best watercress, fill in the blank. So it's understanding, taking the same seed, but how do you stress it in different ways? And that's what Arrow Farms is great at, is understanding the correlations between stressing it and desired outcomes.
And I'll bet you getting the DuPonts and Monsantos of the world to think that doing things without chemicals is a good idea, it's just never going to happen culturally.
Well, actually, they're very excited about what we're doing because it's not only there are benefits for specifically leafy greens, but they're understanding these trade-offs. And the big ag tech companies have a great understanding of how to create a seed, very little understanding of what are the stresses mm-hmm. and the correlations between what happens to that seed in the physical environment and what it becomes. So here there's incredible know-how. Talk about those 28 million data points, and as well as isolating variables so you could really pinpoint what's going on. How do you stress a plant to increase nutritional density? How do you get it so it doesn't uptake if there's more and more contaminated soil?
I'm now imagining the least beautiful vineyard of all time. Make the best wine.
So as it makes the best wine.
With the best grapes.
Yes.
Or the best leaves. So tasting's believing, and from top supermarkets to top chefs, consistently they're saying they've never tasted product as good as our product.
David, let's ask what we asked Joe. Why Newark? And I don't mean to say that. I'm a Jersey girl at heart, and I love the state of New Jersey. But why I think you're getting ready to open a huge headquarters, is that right, here in Newark?
We are. Part of it, I built and led a nanotech company before this. In the city of Newark was our manufacturing. So the state has been great to me since 2002. The city's been great to me. So there's an element of do what works and go back to what you're used to. The business community in the city of Newark is very friendly. It's not hard to get access to decision makers, to influencers, to get things done, to work with partners like whether it's Panasonic Schools like NJIT.
It feels like there's a little bit of an incubator feel here with kind of different people from science and academia.
I'd agree with that. And in addition, we're servicing... We have a social mission of helping communities, and it's not lost on us that there are some real food deserts in the city, and unemployment is above the national average. So we like the fact that we're repurposing. Yeah. It's purposeful to repurpose this old steel factory to create jobs, to alleviate a food desert, as well as we're within some major markets that we could sell to. We sell in ShopRite in Newark, which was the first supermarket we sell to, as well as there's New York City, other areas of northern New Jersey.
David, thank you.
David, let me bring in our next guest. And Tom, forgive me if I mispronounce. I think I hopefully have it right. Tom Wisniewski.
Close enough.
No, what is the correct way?
I would say Wisniewski.
Wisniewski. Thank you very much. He's managing partner at Newark Venture Partners. And you're a programmer, or you were a programmer, an investment banker, venture capitalist, and you announced Newark Venture Partners, I think, just last summer.
Yes.
Tell us what you guys are setting out to do.
So Newark Venture Partners is new and innovative in a couple different ways. We're a venture capital firm. We're a for-profit venture capital fund and an accelerator, right? So we're doing what venture capital firms do, just try and find the best companies to invest in and help them grow and provide a return to all of our stakeholders. At the same time, though, we have a second bottom line. We're about returning economics and good things to Newark. So by investing in companies and bringing them to Newark, we can increase jobs, we can increase tax base, we can increase the perception of Newark as a good place to do business.
And talk to us about how much money you've raised so far and what opportunities have come kind of across your desk.
Yeah, so we've set out to raise a $50 million fund. We've raised about half of that with a really star-studded set of investors. Amazon and its Audible division, Prudential, Dun & Bradstreet, Fidelco, a number of very well-known individual investors, David Blitzer, who's a managing director at Blackstone Group, also one of the owners of the Devils, have all come together to help provide the capital for this, along with a lot of other people who provided other things. Rutgers is a big partner of ours. They provided free space for us in other ways, and there are a number of other individuals who have been catalytic in getting this going.
So interesting that those other people have made the investments. Do they have a notion, do you have a notion that you're going to find a different kind of business because of where you are here?
No, what we seek to do here is to be among the best, right? Well, we have to be more than the best in a sense, because we need to overcome if there are perceptions about Newark, right? We're going to be competing for the best companies and the best co-investors and trying to bring those to Newark.
But are you going to invest only in companies who are in Newark?
No, our role is to find the best companies worldwide, anywhere, and bring them to Newark, right? And to do that, we've got this fantastic space, 25,000 square feet that's been built out. Beautifully, great design team from Amazon put it together. We've got 10 gigs of internet service directly to the desktop. So if you can imagine, that's 10 times what Google Fiber has in Kansas City. It's about 200 times what you have maybe on a business class connection. In addition to that, we have a commitment from Amazon and from Audible to provide mentorship. They have 800 people here in Newark. I had no idea this until I got involved in this. 800 people from the Audible division here already, and they're going to be the mentors, the technologists, the business people that will help our companies. In addition to that, because of Amazon's involvement, we get free cloud computing credits. So it's by putting together this package of all of those things, right, that we're going to attract the best companies out of
the
New York area.
So you use Amazon Web Services, which I would keep arguing is the most important company in the world right now.
Yes, yes. Because of the Amazon partnership.
Next to Panasonic and AeroFarms. Third most important company in the world.
No, I mean, it's an amazing thing. For those who follow sort of financial things, they broke out Amazon Web Services for the first time within Amazon about a year ago, and I think it's something like a $7 or $8 billion
business.
It's
on a $10 billion run rate now.
Yeah.
$10 billion.
It's unbelievable.
And it's big, and it is probably five times bigger than Microsoft's Azure division, which is the second largest.
They have an 80% market share. They serve both Netflix and basically every single startup out there.
And the CIA and Uber.
So not only are they a great resource for our companies and being able to provide cloud computing service, which is what every single startup uses instead of buying machines, but they're also a great great set of individuals to go out there and prospect for us. They know every single startup, right? They have relationships with every single venture capital firm that can be used as a great funnel for us and to bring new and interesting companies.
So let me ask you, Tom, what are the advantages or disadvantages? If I just go across the river, there's a lot of venture capital activity going on in New York City. Are there advantages and disadvantages to being so close to a hub like that?
I think it is advantages. I mean, I think that you can, we're 18 minutes away on a train, right? That's closer than most of Brooklyn, right? And if you see a lot of startups moving outside of places, it's a huge advantage. Now, there is some advantage, obviously, to being in the cool neighborhood in the middle of Manhattan, but it's got some disadvantages there, too. It's very costly. The internet actually sucks in Manhattan. Really, it's really bad if you ever had to put up with it, and I have there. By coming out here, rent is much, much lower. If you come with us, it's actually free. It's included in the package. You've got access to these and individuals who are really involved in this. I mean, Amazon's not involved in this as an investor to try and make money. They want to do something good here. Audible's involved in this because they're trying to give back, right? So there's a lot of people who are providing a lot of extra help and services and things that will help your company do a lot better.
Sounds like Audible's crucial in this.
Absolutely.
Audible has a history in New Jersey, but what do you get the sense out of that?
So it's a very personal thing in a way. Don Katz, who's the CEO and the founder of Audible, and if you know Audible, it's the audiobook company. They actually have been around since the 1990s. They were one of the original internet companies, and they were one of the few actually public internet companies that survived the crash and lived on.
And he was before that, he was a great magazine writer.
He was a writer as well.
I wouldn't have thought he'd have a second act.
Don had his company of about 100 people based in Wayne, New Jersey in 2007 and made the decision to move it to Newark, not unlike some of the discussion we've had with Joe. And he did it because he wanted to position his company to not only do well. He wanted to move it closer to a business center, get access to people and resources, but he also wanted to do good, wanted to provide something back to this urban environment. At the time, people thought he was really sort of crazy to do this. He was would lose people. That didn't happen. They brought 100 people here, lost no one, and now they've grown to 800. They're growing at about a person a day here in Newark, something like that. Fantastically successful. And his thought was, if we can do it here, we can create this tech company, hire the hardest people to hire anywhere, bring them from New York and all around the area. You know, what would Newark be like if it had 10 Audibles in it, right? But we need to grow our own. How do you grow your own? How do you create a tech community? And that's where the foundation for Newark Venture Partners came out of. We need to create a venture capital pool. We need to create the environment and the tools and the resources that will allow tech companies to take root here.
Tom, I'm just curious, are there certain kind of companies that you're going to be looking for investments? Are there certain fields of expertise that you're already interested in that's where you guys want to target the money?
Great companies. We want great companies with great founders. Companies like the next AeroFarms, right? Listening to what he's talking about here, it just sounds amazing, right? I don't know a lot about that particular background, but of biology and such, but there are so many interesting things going on in a variety of different fields. So it's easy to say, in a sense, what we're not going to be doing. We're not going to be trying to do pharma, which is a very dense and difficult. We're not going to be doing clean tech. Software-enabled business, Internet of Things, those kind of things. It's about taking technology, using it to its fullest to solve either a consumer problem or to solve a business problem and create a good business.
I think it was interesting what you said about, you know, you're looking for great founders. And I'm just thinking there might be a student out there who's got an idea. What advice do you have to someone who's got an idea and they're thinking about pitching something or trying to kind of run with it and grow with it?
Because it does sound like you're talking about kind of early stage companies.
Yes. Just to define it, we're going to be doing seed stage investing. So this is putting tens of thousands of dollars of work through sort of later stage seed, putting hundreds of thousands up to Series A, maybe put $1 million. So we're all along that spectrum. But to answer your question, what advice do I have? Look, ideas are great, right? Everyone has ideas, but ideas are cheap. It's about executing. It's about creating a prototype. It's about building a team. You got to be able to do more than just think up the idea. For every person, every idea that you've heard about or business you've heard about that's done really well, there were 12 other people with that idea. It was the drive and the execution behind the one who succeeded, which drove them to that, right? So it's about getting resources, building experience, and building something.
How far along do you think the entrepreneurs should be thinking about what the marketplace is, what the economics of the marketplace is? It's an interesting debate that founders have these days, especially I think after reading about Steve Jobs and thinking he would just say, make a product, you know, we'll figure out what the market is later. First, let's build it. The Google guys said this. They have the same thing to say.
Yeah, well, I think it's easy to say that in retrospect, and there are going to be those examples. I think that, you know, can happen different ways. But I think the more reliable way to think about it is there's a problem somewhere in a market, right? You're trying to understand a consumer problem or a consumer situation, challenges they have, or a business problem. And by understanding that problem, you can tailor a solution to it. Now, you need to be innovative. You have to, the sort of Apple example would be, you want to make sure you're able to jump ahead if you can beyond maybe an incremental solution, but still focusing on what a consumer wants or what a business needs is a much more reliable way of trying to create a good business.
Has the market volatility, though, impacted? Your timing's interesting, right? July, you made the announcement. I'm thinking, was it August we had the market sell-off concern over China? We bounced back a little bit. We came into 2016. Again, we had a huge market sell-off. M&A stopped. IPOs stopped. Mm-hmm. We're just starting to see that come back. I'm just curious how that has impacted you, if at all. Maybe it's a benefit because there are companies that need money. I don't know.
Look, I think the environment in the macro markets is important. You shouldn't be dismissive of that. However, if you understand the innovation that's going on today and how software is changing the world, how we're able to use technology to solve business problems, there is so much pent up demand for that or opportunity for that, that in my mind, it almost doesn't matter where the market's going. Certainly, it'd be easier if it's going up. It'd be harder if it's going down. But we're going to still be creating AeroFarms no matter what.
We're
still going to be creating these companies no matter, because there's just no one's thought about applying technologies in these different ways. So it's less about creating new technology, although that's important, but about using it in these innovative ways. And I think that is somewhat delinked from some of the macro trends that are out there. I think there's also quite a bit of focus out there in the market on the unicorns and about what they're doing.
Right. These are the billion-dollar companies that are still private, some of whom have revenues?
Yes, some of those, some who have revenues. I think they're fantastic companies and great stories, but I think it's very misleading to focus a lot of time on
them.
They're
not all fantastic companies, as we learned with Theranos, right? A company that came out there with lots of pronouncements about what they could do, and they couldn't actually do it, and they were lying about what they're doing, and now they're being punished by the FDA.
Yeah, so if there's a place in the market where I see sort of, I'm scared a little bit, I see those inflated applications, those valuations that you see in the billions, right, that I can't reconcile Uber valuation or some of these others, but that doesn't affect me, right? That doesn't affect me as an investor.
Well, it's going to help you on some level because if venture deals are getting, some of the values are coming down, with it, even at the very top level, the unicorn level, the Fidelities and T. Rose are saying, we're going to mark the value of these down. Mm-hmm. That's going to go all the way through the venture capital ecosystem.
Yeah, it does, but it's, you know, look, I'm looking at companies, right, that have two or three people in them to begin with, right? And they've got an idea and a prototype product. What's going on with Uber seems to have very little effect directly on them. However, it will affect the venture capitalists. Their mood will get better when things are going well and not. So what did happen in the fall is we saw a bunch of venture capital sort of take a step back, right?
Yeah.
And not as much venture capital went out. But if you look at the larger trends of how much capital is being raised and how much what's in the funds, my sense is that's a pause and things are going to continue because there's just such a tremendous amount of opportunity to invest in seed stage companies and to see their growth. And I think we have to understand sort of what a win is. It's about creating a company, a viable company that can be profitable. Many of the companies, 90% of them, were not going to become billion-dollar ones. But that's fantastic. That's still good. Exiting a company or selling a company, the tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, those are fantastic outcomes, right? And that's the heart and soul, I think, of what venture capital returns really are based on. And I think in terms of the focus, it's about, again, creating growth, creating companies that can grow.
How many offers come across your desk on a daily basis?
Well, we see depends on how you count. About 100 to 200 I see through two or three different routes.
Really?
A month, yes.
A month.
As it relates specifically to Newark Venture Partners, I would say it's probably 30 to 40 a month, something like that.
And so what's the hit rate?
Well, we've only begun investing out of the fund in the last couple of months. I can tell you that in every other situation I've been in, the hit rate is about 1 in 100, something like that, right? Now, the 100 counts all the things, all the emails you might receive, all the things you touch, and that's pretty common across venture capitalists and accelerators and other things, 1 in 100, 2 in 100, that kind of a ratio. And it's kind of easy to get from the 100 to the 20 that are good. The hard decisions come when you're trying to get from that 20 and find the one that you really want to invest in.
And if people want to reach out to you, how do they do it?
Reach out to us. We'd love to talk to people who are interested in investing with us, investing in our fund, coming to join us at Newark Venture Partners in the facility, becoming one of our companies, becoming an entrepreneur in residence. So if you go to newark.vc, you can find our website and find out how to get involved.
All right, Tom Wisniewski, thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, great. So hold on. Marcus Weldon joins us right now, CTO at Nokia and also president of Bell Labs. And if you talk about New Jersey and technology and don't mention Bell Labs, you've missed the biggest story in history, right? At least in the history of technology.
Can I just say the transistor?
Yeah.
8 Nobel Prizes have been awarded for work completed there. The laser, the silicon solar cell. I mean, I'm just touching. I mean, it's
is kind that
of,
all?
It's kind of the building blocks of so much of what we do today.
Exactly right. And that's not all. That's just what we did a couple of weeks ago. No, I'm kidding.
Slacker.
Unix, C, C++, a CCD camera that is essentially the digital image sensor in your phone. Mobile networks, optical networks, et cetera, et cetera. So we've done all that, and yeah, we've had 90 years to do that. So, you know, we're not as young. We're not quite as old at Bell Labs anyway as Panasonic. We're certainly not as young as Aerofarms. But it's an amazing accomplishment, and it's very New Jersey. Nearly all of those Nobel Prizes. We actually, by the way, have an Oscar, 2 Grammys, an Emmy, 2 Turing prizes, Japan
Should
prizes.
Should we just shut his mic off now? I mean, really.
But the fun, which is cool, and it's all nearly all of that was done either down in Holmdel, New Jersey, or in Berkeley Heights, New Providence, the Murray Hill campus. And you think, well, why on earth, how did we do that? And the part that people don't often get is we did it by solving human problems. It turns out early on, if you read the early documents from the AT&T archives, it says, telegraph and telecom, or telephone and telegraph. That's where we started. But ever since then, it's been about networks of any type, wireless networks, optical networks, IP networks, which build the internet. So we build all that, but we then solve the problems that are coming. So our trick, and it's a little bit like yours, I think we invent the future by looking 10 years ahead and seeing what it is you will need to go to that next level. And that next level we define as 10 times better than wherever we are today. And of course, we're ambitious, so sometimes we do more than 10 times. But if you do that, and you give yourself enough time, 5, 6, 7 years, you invent a future that's radically different, and you find ways around physical limits, or engineering limits, or mathematics limits. And that's why you win the prizes. The prizes, I like to say, are a nice byproduct. Once I called them sort of our cast-offs. Once we've finished innovating, the prizes are our leftovers or our dessert. The main goal is to solve human problems in what you would now call ICT. But ICT, as we've said so far, covers everything from a device, which
ICT
could be a widget.
What's ICT?
Information and communications technology, okay. Which is the fancy term for cloud networks, devices, and all the systems that run those networks. So that's what we do, and it's all sort of New Jersey innovation and has been for 90 years.
Well, and interesting, because you know, Bell Labs didn't start in New Jersey. It started in Manhattan in the West Village, right? And I wonder what it is about the history of
New York
this.
Is always trying to take things right. away from
know,
us.
Right. No.
Statue of Liberty.
In this case, Statue of Liberty, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But in this case, the
Ellis
move happened
Island.
Quite a long time ago. But I wonder what it is about the history of Bell Labs that has inspired AT&T, no longer Ma Bell, right, to keep it going and keep investing in it when they've had a lot of occasions to want to tighten the belt.
Well, of course, it's no longer AT&T. They have their own labs called AT&T Labs.
Right, sorry, yes.
So when AT&T spun out Lucent, do you all remember Lucent Technologies? Bell Labs went with the Lucent piece because the Lucent piece was the equipment-making piece of AT&T.
And the Lucent piece went with Alcatel, and the Alcatel piece
exactly
goes to
right.
Nokia
and
recently. Yeah.
Exactly right. So we became Alcatel-Lucent, now we've become Nokia. So what's remarkable, it's been many parents who have loved and nurtured
that's what
us.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And they've been French, and they've been Finnish, and they've been American. And the reason is because they keep seeing us succeed. We don't get to just rest on our laurels and say, historically, we've been great, and list our prizes like I did earlier to everyone's annoyance. But it's actually because we keep innovating the future. So we're still building next-generation technologies. That now the buzzword is 5G. You've all got LTE phones, probably, from Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile. We build all those networks, by the way. But 5G is beyond that, and the promise of 5G, get this, if you think you have a reasonable service today, you probably have a megabit per second on average from any one of those providers. The promise of 5G is 10 gigabits per second over wireless, which is tough, but that's a huge gain, right? You go from a megabit to a gigabit is 1,000-fold, so therefore another 10 is 10,000-fold increase. And we've got to do that maybe in 10 years to enable the instrumentation of your world that will enable the farming and the screens and the smart cities. The Internet of Things requires a massive scale, and it's easy to understand that number. There's 6 to 7 billion people, give or take. The prediction is there'll be a trillion things. And so you see the gap between building people networks and thing networks is at least a factor of 100 to 150. And then, of course, we think those things are all going to be generating video, and we're not all generating video. And we need to control things that are going to be moving really fast, like cars and drones. So we've got to build this network that's really low latency, super high capacity. So we think the amount of innovation still to come, and that's what our parent company, Nokia, thinks, is so large that we're worth the bet yet again.
What? Tell us, though, about the culture. And it was interesting reading about kind of the Bell Labs culture, and I think it was an individual, was it Mervyn Kelly? And just this whole idea of having, like, different types of thinkers, critical thinkers, different people all under one roof in close proximity. You know, and I just think about, David, what you said, how you've got the farming component and you've got the software component. Like, you've got all these people who come together and figure out a solution to improve things.
That's an excellent point. And we're no longer just New Jersey, actually, because we ran out of people in New Jersey. No, actually, the real story is we used to import people to New Jersey en masse. We were one of the massive brain drain. We were the sink for the brain drain, where everyone came to New Jersey, and you had to be here if you're in Bell Labs. But now, with modern communications, that's no longer a requirement. So we're in France and Germany and China and Ireland. We're in Silicon Valley as well. We're now in Hungary and Finland, of course. So we're everywhere, and those labs all collaborate together, and there's about 1,000 people across those labs. So we don't just rely on New Jersey, but all the great innovations in the past came from New Jersey. But yeah, we are the other, so that's sort of, think of that as geographic diversity, which is also a little bit cultural, because different cultures actually think a little bit differently. Some are more methodical and some are more inspirational, and across all those sites we get a mix. But we also STEM diverse, because we take scientists from all disciplines, engineers, mathematicians, and technologists in general, and we mix those together. So we mix sites, disciplines, genders, ethnic backgrounds, all of that is our magic, and putting them in contact. Originally it was in one building, and they built these hallways that are, I don't know, I think they might be half a mile long. And the reason was you had to walk past someone else to get to lunch. So it's a little bit like the Steve Jobs idea of the bathroom, I think, was where you all had to go together, which is a bit different.
Or Mike Bloomberg, who we have the food court.
No, oh, the food court.
Where we have to run into.
Yeah, and you get your free snacks.
Life.
I was there last week. It's pretty cool.
All the snacks went last week.
Yeah, that's right. I'm putting on a bit of weight. Long corridors was our solution. It was not a very elegant one, but now we do it with very diverse network groups.
But Steve Jobs was supposedly inspired in that the new Apple headquarters that they're building, which is a donut-shaped building. Walk by everybody in order to get anywhere.
So there you are, you see. We can now legitimately claim we didn't just invent the things that go inside your Apple phone,
right,
but even how they innovate. And I think that's probably somewhat true. Like, all your phone is components not made by Apple apart from the processor, which is based on the transistors. We always forget these magical elements. The thing that is allowing anyone to build the next generation internet all came from New Jersey.
One of the things that I do for Bloomberg Television, whenever the new Apple iPhone comes out, is I break it apart and I get with these guys who help me identify the parts. So we get the brand new most coveted item in the world, and then we smash it and take it apart and go through chip by chip try to identify all the little pieces, because it's fascinating.
It's fascinating. But I think you're absolutely right. Our magic is, you know, I wrote this on my blog, but it's best and brightest, and that used to be you had to come to New Jersey, but now we'll tolerate other places. And then it's get them to collaborate with diverse disciplines and then set the bar incredibly high. What does the future have to look like? Factors of 1,000, factors of 100, and that makes you think differently.
You know, you mentioned transistors, and I think in reading about Bell Labs, they took, you know, a few years to get that done. Do you still have the same luxury of taking time? And I actually want to put this out to all of you. Do you have the time to let things breathe and figure out the best solution for things? Or is there a lot of pressure to get things done now? Especially if you happen to be a publicly held company.
Yeah, that's what's been great about all our parents, is because they understood that the model was, you know, there's a work by Kotter from Harvard that says a successful big company should have two operating systems. One should be innovating and doing crazy stuff. The other should be doing volume manufacturing, highly efficient, and high-performance stuff. And those two things should be decoupled. And nearly all of our parents have understood that. The coupling comes from when you're ready to couple and creating awareness, because
this goes back to the Tinder thing you were talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. Swipe on ready.
It all goes back to Tinder, I'm just telling you.
But that's exactly right. And you couple when you're ready, which means when the idea has got somewhere, you talk, etc. And so all our parents have understood that. And so I don't actually feel more temporal pressure. I feel the same pressure to disrupt. And maybe the market says that it used to be 10 years and now it's 7 from the first idea. Even venture capital companies typically sort of 5, 7, 10 years to become big. We're about the same as that. So we just start research 10 years before the market need, and then we're ready in time, and then you don't have that time pressure.
Well, let me ask Joe Taylor, Panasonic. I mean, when you guys were making your changes, did you feel like you had the luxury to take some time to get things done?
No, we didn't have any luxury because, as I mentioned, we were losing billions of dollars.
But
I completely agree. We have two models. So we have the old manufacturing model. I shouldn't say the old manufacturing model, but it makes wonderful products better than anybody in the world, and that pays all the bills. But that's not enough. You can't stay relevant that way. And we have another section that is charged with the innovation of the creation of new technologies and new solutions to provide services and really to make people's lives better through the use of technology. So they're two different models. I completely agree.
Well, David, as you guys run your business, I mean, are you doing that? You're kind of playing around with some things, and but you're running the core business.
We are. We're building our eighth facility. It's what we call version 2.5. And at the same time, if you look at our priorities on our engineering side, we're working on version 3.0, version 4.0, and there is what's called design creep. So at what point do you just say, all right, pens down, this is the design we're going for, but at the same time, you want to let some of these more innovative ideas work. At the same time, we go through that on the biological side, where our horticulture team has small zigs. So we, in our facility, where everything's grown to sell, we're constantly tweaking, but there are small tweaks. So everything's sold. The customer doesn't necessarily notice if an item might be more tender or a little harder.
What's with this kale?
What's with this kale? But in our R&D facility, then there are bigger movements. And all of this, like I'm going to China tomorrow, and we're looking to build some facilities in China. So here, there's an element of, all right, we haven't finished the biggest one in the world, and there's automation in seeding, harvesting, cleaning, packaging, so what we call the processing side, we're still building that, and at the same time, we're building other ones, adding on complexity with other countries. So at what point are we going too fast versus kind of making sure we're at a pace we could manage?
I'm guessing, Tom, as a venture capitalist, you just have to be patient, right, to let those ideas kind of grow a little
bit. Well, yes. It's in one way, most people don't realize, but the average hold time for a seed stage investment for me putting...
Was that a pun? Because if that was a
pun, that was good, yeah.
I mean, wow.
Seeds at AeroFarm. Nice. Yeah, I guess you're always raising your seed round at AeroFarm. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
In the more general kind of seed round is 8+ years for putting your money into an exit. Those are for the ones that succeed. So from that standpoint, yes, there needs to be quite a bit of patience. And often it is not the venture capitalist, the investor, who really dictates that time frame. It's how the company is doing. It's what's going on in the markets. At the same time, you have to be very impatient in the sense of you're constantly looking for progress and moving things forward.
Things move so
things
quickly.
Having ideas and it's not good enough. Probably never was good enough, but I think in today's world, you need to be aggressively thinking about what's going on tomorrow, the day after. It's about quick developments, about getting things to market. It's about moving quickly in all sorts of other ways.
And one of the things you can think about these two operating systems, you've got a ready-made factory in the big thing, right? So when the innovator is ready, you can, if the big operating system is running well, they can inherit this and you're ready to go. So that can be an accelerant even for a big company that's not quite as agile.
I don't get it. Explain again.
So if I'm innovating over on the, call it the crazy operating system, okay, the one that's actually inventing the future, and I've got the factory, which is the big company that's funding that.
So in this case, if you've got Bell Labs and you've got Grandpa Nokia.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm sorry, Nokia. I'm trying to learn. I'm working on my Nokia.
We actually had a debate of this. It is Nokia. Yeah, exactly. So as long as they're aware it's coming, because they don't like a shock, they actually, what you have is a big flywheel that the innovation can go into and is good at volume manufacturing. Whereas a startup has to scale that piece. So if we get it right, the two things are not bad to have together. In fact, that's the argument Cotter makes. That's the optimal model, whereas a startup has to grow that part over time.
Tom, can I ask you from a venture capital standpoint with Newark Venture Partners, if you look at, you know, when I look from, you know, so I'm mostly in San Francisco, Silicon Valley. I'm in New York City a lot, and I'm from New York, and I live out there, so I've got this sort of feeling about what both places are about. And the venture side of the Bay Area is focused on all kinds of things, except for really media. And I feel like the venture, Silicon Alley, at least over the course of the last 15 years or so, has been very heavily focused on media. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you feel like you have certain industries. I mean, everyone would like to invest in the next Google, the next Uber, mm-hmm. or the next, you know, Ma Bell, right? But what do you feel like your specialties are going to be, the places where you're really going to get some efficiencies of your own and you're going to start to really know some industries and innovators in those industries better than any other?
Yeah, I mean, I think, but I love the coastal model and the reflections on that, because there's a lot of misconceptions too out there about differences between them. But I would say the thing that New York has, you know, that everyone recognizes is it's a capital of business, probably the capital of business. And what I would say is if you look at the revolution that's happened in the last 5-6 years in venture capital, it has been more about using technology to solve business problems, right, than it has been around creating new technology. And that is the reason why New York has flourished as a center for this, because the business is there and it has become a magnet for the technology side. I mean, there had been
venture capital and technology there before, right? But so what are those things that New York is good at? It's good at mixing those, creating the, you know, taking a problem in a sleepy industry, could be moving, could be, you know, some back corner of publishing, right, that has a problem. We have people who come from that industry, we understand that, we put them together with technologists, and we're able to solve a meaty business problem or create a new different angle. I think that kind of thinking creates great companies. If we're missing out on the East Coast, it may be in the super big ideas. I don't feel like we're going to probably create the next Facebook here yet. I don't think we're aiming for those home
Speaking
runs
of
all the
Jersey
time.
Speaking of New Jersey residents, yeah. Mark Zuckerberg, yeah.
I think I'm happy to do innovation in in great B2B companies and great consumer marketplaces and plays, things that can create. Great company, great wealth. They don't need to be the next unicorn in order to be super successful.
David, what are your thoughts? Obviously, the tri-state area known for its farming.
Well, it's never. One of the competitive
It is
never.
The Garden State, Corey Johnson.
One of the competitive advantages for this area is also capital formation. So we're right next to Wall Street, especially like Aero Farms. There's a capital intensity.
You guys have raised $75 million, I've read?
On debt and equity. So on the equity is very precious to a company, to an early stage company. So you want to find ways to bring capital together where you're not diluting yourself. So our bankers, Goldman Sachs and Prudential, it's very nice to go across the street or across the river and work with big banks to figure this out, to problem solve. There's a lot of innovative minds, a lot of smart people, and a lot of capital where you can figure out models.
I mean, if you think about the problem that we're trying to solve here, what we're trying to do collectively here in Newark, it has some similarities to what's gone on in Detroit, right, with pre-gentrification, and also what's happened in Las Vegas, where Tony Hsieh has tried to get off the ground there. But I think, you know, to what David was saying,
Tony Hsieh, the founder of Zappos,
another Amazon company. But getting trying to use technology to revitalize a city, we have a distinct advantage. We're not thousands of miles away from something. We're a few miles away. We have direct access. We're already part of that ecosystem.
A lot of infrastructure here.
Out in Detroit, you're trying to build an island in the middle of an ocean. Here, we've just got to latch on to a great set of resources that are right here.
We just have 2 minutes. He's the boss left. And what I
Paul
wanted
Burner,
to ask
our producer.
You. Because here we are at here we are at NJIT, and I'm just thinking about the education, the type of workforce that you need. So I'm going to ask you to be quick. I'm just going to kind of rapidly go down. But Joe, what are you looking in terms of the workers that you need and the type of backgrounds?
You know, I think studying technology is great, but technology historically has always been developed to solve a problem. And we're at a point in time now where technology far exceeds even our ability to think of ways to use it. So from my viewpoint, I'm looking for young people who understand the basics of the STEM studies, but couldn't decide whether they wanted to be a poet or an engineer. They have kind of left and right. And I'm looking for more creativity in the technology side to find different ways to approach problems.
Soft and hard skills. David, I'm going to give you about 20 seconds.
Data analytics, if I had to pick one. But we hire a lot of engineers, a lot of people with some experience in biology and statistics and data analytics. We have the Harvard, the MIT, the Columbia people. We're proud that we also have a lot of the NJIT people as well.
Tom, 15 seconds.
Software engineers that like to be hackers, that like to build things, create stuff, right? And see how it works.
Says the venture capitalist.
Yeah. Well before I see it, I want people out there creating new things, hacking together stuff.
You were a programmer.
I was, way back when.
Marcus.
Best and brightest. Anyone, any discipline, anytime, anywhere.
What's as best and brightest to you, though?
Actually, a free thinker. That it could be slightly on the artistic side. It could be slightly on the inspirational sort of scientific side. That's what I want. Those people change the world.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Well, this was inspiring.
Thanks,
folks,
everybody here at NJIT as well.
Great was it? Joe Taylor, David Rosenberg, Tom Wisniewski, and Marcus Relding. We have been live from New Jersey Institute of Technology, one of the nation's leading public polytechnic universities. NJIT preparing students to be leaders in the technology-dependent economy of the 21st century. This is the Bloomberg Advantage, prime time on Bloomberg Radio.